They get into positions and they don't help others. I mean, and I think that's key, that when we do get into these positions, it's no point us getting there if we're not gonna bring others with us.
Hello and welcome to the Medical Women Podcast, the world's first podcast aimed at supporting and empowering medical women in their careers. I'm Dr. Nuthana Bayankaram, and it's my honour and joy to be your host as each week we speak to a fantastic guest who's here to help us in our careers. I'm Vice President of the Medical Women's Federation, the largest body of women doctors in the UK, and the voice of medical women on medical issues. Join us as each week we hear about a topic that's helpful for all of us in our careers. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Medical Women Podcast. I hope you are all well. Autumn has definitely arrived in the UK. It's feeling very, very cold. And I'm really, really excited that we are on season four and on this how-to series. Thank you so much for all of the lovely feedback on episode one. This week, we are hearing from Miss Samantha Tross, who is a consultant orthopaedic surgeon practicing in London. She specializes in treating conditions of the hip and knee. Samantha became a consultant in 2005 and was the first woman of Afro-Caribbean descent in the UK to become a consultant orthopaedic surgeon. In 2018, she scored another first by becoming the first woman in Europe to perform Mako robotic hip surgery. In this episode, we discussed what it's like to be the first at something. A lot of the times we hear, you can't be what you can't see. But if you're the first, then you have to be what you can't see. And we also discussed how important it is, once you are the first at something, to make sure that you're not the last. In this episode, Sam spoke about the importance of mentorship and sponsorship and what the differences are between these. And although she's the first woman of Afro-Caribbean descent in the UK to become a consultant orthopaedic surgeon, a lot of her mentors and sponsors didn't look like her, but they still really helped her. And I think this episode just highlights how important it is to have a range of mentors and sponsors, regardless of whether they are similar to us or not. And it just shows how important it is to have different people's voices being heard and different people around the table, because it's that diversity that really represents our patients and makes us better as leaders and as a profession to have that diversity. I really, really enjoyed talking to Sam and hope that you really enjoy listening to this episode. So welcome back to the Medical Women Podcast, and I'm delighted to be joined by Miss Samantha Tross this week. Welcome, Samantha, to the podcast. It would be wonderful if you could introduce yourself to our listeners.
Thank you so much for having me, Nithana. My name is Samantha Tross, as you said. I'm a consultant orthopaedic surgeon specializing in treating conditions of the hip and knee. I've been in post since 2005. And when I was appointed, I became the first female of African Caribbean origin to do so in the United Kingdom. So that was a bit of a surprise to me, actually. I didn't know that at the time, because perhaps then it might have been an unwanted burden. But anyway, no, so that's what I found out. And then I scored another first in 2018, becoming the first woman in Europe to perform Mako robotic hip surgery. Again, going after my passion and not aiming to be the first, but happy to get that accolade.
Oh, wonderful. And there's, lots of things that I want to unpick within that, but it'll be great to hear a bit more about kind of, your journey to becoming a consultant. And as you said, you said you didn't know at the time, you weren't aiming to, like, I want to be the first woman of Afro-Caribbean descent to be a consultant orthopaedic surgeon in the UK. And I'd love to explore, on your journey, because lots of the time I think people say, oh, we have to see people, like, you have to see yourself in somebody who looks like you, it's a, to believe that you can do it. But when you're the first, you don't have that. So I'd love to explore that a
Yes,
bit with you.
sure. So look, I am not from a medical family per se. My mom was a nurse, so I did go and visit her in hospital. So I was used to being in the hospital, and perhaps that had some influence on me. I'm not entirely sure. I know that I faced death at a very young age. My grandmother died at age 3, and that's my earliest living memory. It's very clear to me.
Oh,
But I think the reason why it's so clear is because it was very traumatic for my mother. But it stayed in my mind. And then subsequently, my dad's aunt, who also lived with us, died at home. And then I lost a friend quite young. So I think that perhaps being faced with death, going to visit my mom in the hospital, and then I was a very avid reader and perhaps read about medicine, surgery somewhere, I don't know. But apparently at age 7, I made a declaration to the family that I'm going to be a surgeon when I grow up. And I didn't say doctor, interestingly. I said I'm going to be a surgeon.
Oh,
And
wow.
I stuck with wanting and pursuing medicine throughout schooling. But when I got to medical school, of course, there were other careers that caught my attention. I really was quite fascinated by psychiatry. I liked cardiology. But, essentially, I came back to surgery because I excelled at anatomy. It seemed very natural to me. I like the fact that surgical specialties, you have an intervention and you see a quick result. For me, the medical specialties appear to be a little bit too chronic. And similarly with the psychiatry as well, I didn't feel that, these patients were sort of long term. And I realized quite early that I was someone that didn't particularly like chronicity. So, I think you've got to know yourself in order to choose your career adequately. Other reasons for choosing orthopedics is that, quite frankly, I rotated through different specialties. I was at the time when, training at the time when one can spend a significant proportion of time in a specialty. I mean, these days you get 4 months, and before you're settling in, you're moving off. But I had 6 months in each specialty, and I rotated through quite a few. So I did 6 months of general surgery, 6 months of vascular, that's dealing with the blood vessels. And our listeners are hopefully medical, they know what that means. 6 months of neurosurgery, the brain, spinal cord, and nerves, and so on. 6 months of plastic surgery and 6 months of orthopedics. And the orthopedic surgeons, quite frankly, were the most welcoming. I mean, my general surgical colleagues were equally nice, but again, orthopedics is a clean specialty. I didn't have to deal with the bowels. So I felt that, it had a combination of people who were nice to me. It was a clean specialty. The patients were generally well with an injured body part. So they weren't really sick, unless you're dealing in a trauma center, then of course you have some very sick patients. The first female surgeon I ever saw when I was a medical student happened to be an orthopedic surgeon. And I think subliminally that also had an effect. And so all these things in combination, orthopedics offers you a variety of patients. You've got young and old, male and female. And then within the subspecialties, there's really something for everyone. There's the more delicate end of surgery, which is hand surgery, to the more sort of physical end, which I'm in hip and knee surgery.
And yeah, what was interesting there when you were sharing that is, it makes such a difference, the team that we're with. It's not just the
Absolutely.
specialty. If you have a good experience as a medical student, that can really make you think, oh yes, I could fit in here. And it works the other way as well. If you have a bad experience, it can completely put you off a specialty.
Exactly. And the funny thing is, I've had so many people tell me they've had such bad experience in orthopedics, and that's why they'd never choose it as a career. And it was just luck of the draw. I mean, had I ended up somewhere else in another department, I might have chosen something else. So yes, it's a bit of luck.
Yeah, absolutely. Making me think about my orthopedic placement as a medical student. I don't think I saw any female orthopedic surgeons actually, but I vividly remember going on a ward round, and there was a 103-year-old woman who had just had a hip replacement. And she was asking the consultant, when can I go home? Because I want to go back to my dance classes. And I thought, this is
Wow, this is
brilliant.
wonderful. Exactly.
103 going to dance classes. That's what I want to
Exactly.
be like. Because just as a society, we don't get that many like positive messages about aging. So yeah,
Yes,
that
that
was
was
a
excellent.
yeah,
And
that
then it
was a good
inspire you to
experience.
think, my goodness, I could be giving back, someone there their mobility and whatever. That didn't inspire you, Mizana?
Well, I did enjoy orthopedics as a medical student, actually. I think I enjoyed everything, but I think I decided, like you did at the age of 7, I decided I was going to do pediatrics.
Right.
So,
Okay.
despite being interested in everything else, I thought, well, I'll stick to that. But orthopedics and pediatrics, they both have the ped for child in them. So I
That's
suppose
right.
that's
That's
what
right. You got close.
got close, yeah.
Lovely. Yeah.
And now I was saying just before we started recording that when people kind of speak about you or introduce, people were saying, oh, you must have Samantha Tross on the podcast. She was the first woman of Afro-Caribbean descent to become a consultant orthopedic surgeon in the UK. How does it make you feel being the first one? Is it like I imagine it's mixed emotions, but I'd
It
love to
is
hear from
mixed. It is
you.
mixed. Yes. I mean, obviously, an immense sense of pride once I found out. Why did it take so long? I asked myself. I mean, I found out that I'm not the first Black woman to be in orthopedics. Someone, although I've never met them, I heard that there was someone, but she was a staff grade, so never made it to consultant level. So they have been Black women in orthopedics before. I'm not the first in the specialty, but the first to make it as a consultant. And I mean, you think about it, that was 2005. I mean, that's a long time. And since then, we're only now six in number. There's still a lot of work to be done there. And looking outside, being a Black woman, just looking at women, we only make up 6% of the consultant body. Though things are improving, and we're seeing 18% now of orthopedic trainees are female, so there's some improvement. But back to my story, how did it make me feel? Yes, I felt proud when I became aware, but also there's that sense of responsibility that comes with it, because you know that how you present yourself and that may impact others coming after you. So there is a bit of a responsibility there, and as I said. Luckily, it came at a time when I was perhaps a bit more self-assured. I mean, as a trainee, there were other pressures, and that wouldn't have been one I needed to add to it. So I'm glad I wasn't aware when I was coming through.
Yeah. How were you made aware of it?
Because once I qualified, I started asking the college. I mean, they're very poor at having information, but I just started doing research because I wanted to find out who else was there, and I found there wasn't anyone else. Who knows? In future, we might find that there was someone and it was buried somewhere. But I've asked around extensively, and I was told there's no one else. So that's how it is, just from my own curiosity.
Yeah, and I think you touched on having a responsibility there, and I think that's such an important point, because a lot of the time, when not just in medicine, just in general, looking at women kind of being given leadership roles and things, they can be given the role, but then if they are the first, whatever it is, there is that sense of I'm not only representing myself, but I'm representing other people who might look like me, or who might be similar to me. So then there's that responsibility of that if I don't do well in this, then people will think, oh, well, this is what happens when we give, when we give this role to somebody like that. So there is that huge sense. And how did you like deal with that? What kind of things did you do?
Yeah, so look, I didn't make that the forefront, put it in the forefront of my mind, because I think that can be very limiting. Yes, I was aware of it, but I focused on just doing the best that I could do. I mean, that's all you can do is do your best. And thereafter, hopefully that is good enough. Well, yeah, but from that, people can then see that you are capable, and therefore there's no reason why someone who looks like you can't do equally as well. I mean, so I just focus on always doing my best.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful, because that's all
Yeah.
we can do. All we
That's all
can
we
do is
can
focus
Yeah.
on doing our best. So yeah, I think that's great. And it's great that we are kind of getting more women coming through different specialties like orthopedics, which has a history of being very male dominated. And I wonder what kind of things do you think we can all do to help support women in all different specialties?
I think that when they come, as you know, the influence you have as someone in the role is powerful. And so when you have medical students that come and are attached, or even someone coming on a work placement, as often students do, to be very welcoming to them, and to highlight the positives of the career. I think paint a realistic picture. You can't not say what potential challenges they might face, but that overall that is worth it, and just highlight the important things. But it's to be welcoming. I think that's really is the key, and I think that's what we need to do. And then when women see that we are happy in our roles, then obviously, as when they see that example, they will then feel more encouraged to do the same. So that's the best I think that we can do.
Yeah, and I think, really important that we are welcoming, as you say, because like you spoke before, that the teams that we're in when we're medical students or foundation doctors, it can make such a difference on how you then perceive that whole specialty.
Definitely.
And yeah, it's making me kind of reflect. Sometimes when we get the medical students on the ward, it's when you're like really short-staffed and really busy and you don't
That's
have
the
the
point. That's the thing. And and it's just little gestures, little bit, like for instance, in orthopedics, when I was working, the consultant, we were in two main hospitals. I was a house officer, I think, at that point. So prior to that, as a medical student as well, when you go on forums and people actually pay attention to you, because often you feel like a spare part as a medical student, in the way you're a nuisance at best. So they didn't make me feel that way. They engaged me. For whatever reason, but I was very enthusiastic. So I think how you act as well can have some impact. But overall, people need to be aware that sometimes students are nervous or they're out of their comfort zone. So don't necessarily judge their actions on what you see there, because there can be a lot of things going on. Yeah, so they really made me feel. And then when I became a house officer, and I was in an orthopedic firm, it was two hospitals. One was a big hospital, and then there was like a smaller sister sort of cottage hospital. And I would go to assist the consultant operate their lumps and bumps, small cases. And after a few cases, he'd say, right, you are now the surgeon, and I'm here to assist you. I mean, it made me feel so important. And I'd pass the swab, do this, and I thought, oh my God, I'm a surgeon. And just little things like that, just made a huge difference. And I just felt I had more attention in that. Although I had a very good sponsor in general surgery, and he was an amazing guy. But as I say, it's more than being nice, it's the other things as well that the specialty offered. So with general surgery, I didn't particularly want to be dealing with the bowels. And also, most patients can be very sick, and they can become sick, at very inappropriate times. In orthopedics, by and large, unless you're in a trauma center, most stuff is done in sociable hours. You can put it in a plaster and you can deal with it the next day. And I thought that was important, because when someone who wants to consider balancing a family life, these are important considerations.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm really glad that you touched on that there. I'd love to hear how you have found kind of that juggle of the work and the family life. I'm kind of taking notes from everybody that comes on the podcast.
Well, I didn't do a very good job. That's the truth. I mean, so I'm not married. I don't have any children. So perhaps didn't do a great job there. But I think it is important. And we have examples of women who have done orthopedics, and I know numerous who have married and have kids. So it's something that's absolutely possible. And I'm sure other specialties can speak for themselves, but orthopedics certainly gives you that opportunity. And now, of course, we've got flexible patterns of working, etc. So there's much more scope to be inviting and to encourage diversity.
Yeah, which is so important. And when you were speaking there, you used the word sponsor rather than mentor for the consultant GI surgeon. And I'd love to explore that a bit with you, because lots of times when people come on the podcast, they speak about the importance of mentorship, but sponsorship is so
It's
important.
a
I think it's
different
something
level.
that, yeah, and I think it's something that that most of us don't really think about. So I'd love if you can speak a bit more about what you meant there by sponsor.
Yeah, well, I have been so lucky. I have had more than mentors. I've had sponsors. Sponsors are people who go over and beyond. They not just give you advice, but they actually make connections for you. They push you forward and enable you to achieve advancement within your career. I can think of three that I've had, and I've just been very fortunate. And they were just people who saw something in me, and obviously perhaps recognizing that I was unique, and they wanted to make sure that I succeeded. And they were putting me in places I didn't want to be, but it was important, and they were pushing me in. So I had a consultant who, at the time, Professor Bentley was his name, at Stanmore Hospital, was the man that everyone needed to, you know, he would decide who got what job and so on. And my consultant sent me along as a senior house officer, now we call those foundation trainees, to go and meet this guy. He said, you know, you got Professor Bentley needs to know who you are. I'm thinking, you know. So anyway, I went off to meet Professor Bentley, who looked most disinterested in meeting me. I felt as though I was disturbing his day, quite frankly. And he said a few words to me, and I was sort of quickly dismissed. And I came back to my cousin and said, what's the point? He said, no, you were seen. He now knows who you are. That's the key, you know? And a couple of years later, I was sent back again to go and see the guy again. I mean, having not much to say, I hadn't really achieved being sent. Other things that were happening is I remember a consultant, because I just had a fear of public speaking, and he wrote a draft for a paper, submitted it, and when it got accepted, he said, right, you're going to go and present at this conference. And I was like, oh my God, you know, but pushing me, always constantly pushing. So I had lots of those sort of things, and then being taken to meetings, being introduced to different people. So there was a lot of that taking place. So that's what I mean by sponsorship.
Wonderful. And if somebody's listening to this thinking, oh, well, I don't have a sponsor, I've not thought about this before. It's hard to kind of give advice for how you go and find a sponsor, because you never went up to these people and said, oh, will you be my sponsor?
Exactly. But you know what? There's no harm in asking, because what's the worst you're going to get? Is sorry, I can't help. And that's not going to kill you. You know? Well, you know, when you hear no, you just move on to the next person and ask again. And eventually, hopefully, somebody will say yes. But I think we get so frightened, don't we? We build up this story in our heads, and that paralyzes us from actually taking action. But the worst that can happen is a person says no. That's it. And the day continues.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. And I liked what your consultant did there, sending you to go and see this professor that, even if he only spoke to you for a couple of minutes, he knew who you were. He knew that you existed.
Exactly.
Because people can't give us opportunities and or jobs and things if they don't know.
That's correct. Yeah. So, I mean, and at the time I was like, oh my God, why is this guy embarrassing me? Why is he? But, you know, it was really important because, you know, when you go there in front of the professor, he's shuffling his papers and he hardly looks up at you. You're sitting there thinking, what am I doing here? But yes, I'm really eternally grateful. I want to say them by name, my sponsors, by the way. Richard Earlham, who was a general surgeon and upper thoracic surgeon. He did a lot of upper GI stuff at the Royal London in Whitechapel. Professor Fred Heatley, who's an orthopedic surgeon and the head of the training program and the guys in St. Thomas's rotation. And Mr. David Lighthouder, who was a consultant orthopedic surgeon in Basildon and became the president of the orthopedic section of the Royal Society of Medicine. And, you know, when he was president, I was always invited to meetings and he had me sitting up at presidential table with him, you know. I mean, that sort of pushing. Forever grateful to these guys.
What's really interesting there is that your three sponsors that you've mentioned, they're all men. And I think that highlights a really important point that, you know, sometimes we think that we have to find mentors or sponsors that are like us, but we can learn so much from everybody.
Definitely. They were not only all men, they were all white men. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's For me, that you can find allies everywhere, and some of your best allies will definitely not look like you. People who you expect to be your allies might disappoint you. So don't expect because someone looks like you, they're going to be supporting you. I mean, that's a misnomer there. So yes, I think you go out there, you try to do your best, and don't be afraid to ask those around you for sponsorship, etc. And if they can't help, you never know, they might point you in the direction of someone who can. But I think a lot of the times we inhibit ourselves with our own fears, and we need to just be bold.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, you've given us so many pearls of wisdom here. It's been really, really helpful. And yeah, I think you touched on a really another really important point there that just because somebody looks like you, as you said, it doesn't mean that they will be an ally. And sometimes I think particularly at the moment when people are thinking of kind of diversity and inclusion on boards, they think, oh, well, there is a black person there or a brown person there, but that doesn't matter. It's not a tick box exercise. It's whoever the person is, they need to actually be an ally and an advocate for colleagues.
That's right, because we have some senior people who, they get into positions and they don't help others. I mean, and I think that's key, that when we do get into these positions, it's no point us getting there if we're not gonna bring others with us. What's the point? We have to be able to get in there and try and change the landscape. I think that's key. And that's what I'm trying to do with my diversity work, is to try and make a difference, excuse me, a difference in some way.
And could you tell us a bit more about the diversity work that you do?
Yeah, so, oh gosh, quite a few things. So I'm currently the tr a trustee and founder member of the British Association of Black Surgeons. And it was very important for us to form that organization because so many of our black surgeons feel disempowered, and they don't feel that they have equal opportunities. They don't feel that they're being listened to, and it's important to have that support network. Now, it'd be nice to get to a stage one day when society is not necessary, but it very much is necessary now. And the reason I'm stating that is that I was asked by a very senior black surgeon why it is that we're forming the society. Well, unfortunately, the experiences, there's so many things, intersectional things that come into play. I mean, if you're a person from a minority background, but you've come from a high socioeconomic class, perhaps, where you've got other people in your family who are doctors, you're going to have a different experience from someone who hasn't, and that sort of thing. And so, because you had a good experience doesn't mean that others are having a good experience. And so it's absolutely key that we are there and that we fight for equity in training and opportunities. So I'm from that. I'm on the Cultural and Diversity Committee of the British Hip Society. Again, when I first started going to British Hip Society meetings, I used to be the only woman in the room apart from the reps that were there. These are representatives from the orthopedic companies. And orthopedics is this surgical specialty with the least diversity in all aspects, whether it's gender, race, etc. And I felt that, initially I stopped going, to be honest, because it didn't feel a place that I fitted in. And I thought, well, why am I c coming along to these meetings? But the landscape is changing now. And I also felt I owed it to my trainees because you make important connections when you get into different committees. And if I want to be able to be a sponsor for my trainees, then I need to be in these spaces. So I'm on that committee. I'm the secretary for the International Orthopaedic Diversity Alliance, which is a collaboration or a collection of surgeons from all over the world who are interested in diversity. We've got over 1,000 members. I'm on the EDI Forum for the Royal College of Surgeons. I was part of the diversity review carried out by the Royal College of Surgeons. I was part of that committee to look into ways of for this college to improve on its diversity and so on. So yes, these are different areas that I'm involved in. I'm involved in other societies as well, the Black Caribbean Doctors and Dentists Association as well, similar to the British Association of Black Surgeons, but the other one is just Caribbean people, because we have noticed that, even within the Black community, not the outcomes are not equal across the board. So that the Black Africans are doing better than the Black Caribbean. So we need to sort of focus on that.
Okay.
Similarly, when you look in the Asian background, Indians are doing better than Pakistani, than better than those from a Bangladeshi background, etc. So, and often people just treat this as one group, a collective, and you're ethnic minority, but there are different nuances there, and not everyone is doing as well as each other. Asians are doing better than Blacks, for instance, as a whole. But when you look at socioeconomic class, there isn't a difference, and things like that. So we need more information. And we can really look at the data and give targeted support to different groups rather than just one sort of mass action.
Yeah, I think yeah, you just, as always, you just keep making so many, like, within one answer, there's just so many important points there. And yeah, all the work that you're doing sounds amazing. And I think, my favorite point that you made there is that we do these things, being in these spaces isn't just about us. It's actually about, in order to be a sponsor to our colleagues and our trainees, we need to be in those spaces so that we can then find opportunities for them. So I think you've highlighted some really important points there. I've got some quick fire questions for us before
Sure.
we finish, if that's okay.
Yeah, of
So the
course.
first question that I always like to ask is about books, because I love reading. So
All
is
right.
there one or two books that you would recommend to our listeners to read? And they don't have to be anything to do with medicine. They can be about anything
Yeah,
at
I mean,
all.
look, at the moment I'm all about self-development and self-growth. And I think, I'm a lifelong learner. And so what books have I read? It's all about that. I mean, a friend of mine has just written a book called The Heart Knows, Selwyn Collins. I'm advertising for him. And
You're being
it's
a
all about
sponsor here.
cultural awakening, so that's an excellent book which I'm currently reading. What else have I read recently? It's all around self-development. That's where my reading is at the moment. A lot of my stuff, when I say I read, I actually listen, because I don't know about you, but I find it very difficult to make time to sit down and just stop and read. And so when we talked about that work-life balance, I don't think I've quite got it right, but it's something that I continually strive for. But I'm often having the book whilst I'm driving between hospitals, or I'm getting on with the washing or something, and I have the book in the background. So I've got it all here on my Audible. Oh, The Four Agreements by Don Miguel Ruiz. I think that's very key. I mean, and the four agreements are: these are keys for success in any area of your life. Be impeccable with your word. What does that mean? It means that be careful how you choose your words, because words are powerful, and once it's out there, it's out there. So that's the key: being impeccable with the word. Second thing, never make assumptions. So when you see something happening, you're only seeing a snapshot of what's taking place. Unless you have the full picture, you can't really know what's going on. So let's, for instance, somebody comes and someone's horrible to you. And then you go off and you think that is a horrible person. But that person just had something happen to them. And that's affected their mood, and therefore now they're horrible. Unless you see the full picture. You see what I'm saying? So never make assumptions. Sometimes, things aren't what they appear. Ask. If in doubt, ask. The third one is don't take things personally. Same thing. You don't know why this person's done what they've done. And then now you've gone away, it's impacted you. You've taken it on board, it's become a burden to you. Why? Don't let someone else spoil your day. So don't take things personally. And then the fourth one is do your best. Always do your best. And if you just follow those four agreements, I think you'll be okay by and large. You know what I mean? There you go. So that I think is a very important book. The other one that I really liked was, well, of course, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. It's all about driving and business and stuff like that. I need to read more relaxing books, so I don't really do that. Always about self-empowerment and self-development. That's where my head is. Master Your Emotions, that's another one that I read recently. So you can see where I spend my time.
Oh no, I'm the same. I read a lot of kind of self-development books, and I think you're right. I think I need to start using the audio versions a bit more, because I do find it easier to,
It's
you know, as you
tough,
say, like
yeah.
while you're driving, while you're doing the laundry, you can absorb it in audio format, whereas actually sitting and physically reading the book is a bit trickier. And the next question that I'd like to ask you is a question that I'm borrowing from a group of children and young people at the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health. They asked this question when they were interviewing people for the role of president of the Royal College, and they very kindly let me borrow the question. So the question is, if you were a type of biscuit, what type of biscuit would you be and why?
Wow, if I was a type of biscuit, well, it's gonna be dark and chocolatey on the outside, obviously. dark, chocolatey, and sweet, because my middle name is Zoisa, which means sweet thing. So with that theme. And something that's gonna be firm on the outside, but quite soft inside. So what biscuit can we think of that has that description? I don't eat many biscuits, so but that's the kind of biscuit I'm gonna be. It's gonna be a chocolatey biscuit that has a hard outer coating and a nice gooey bit in the middle. That's me in a nutshell.
Wonderful. I'm trying to think what kind of biscuit would fit that description. Maybe a chocolate bourbon biscuit, because it's got
got the cream
the layers
inside.
of the biscuits, and then it's got the cream inside, and it's
Yes,
quite
maybe,
sweet and
maybe.
soft as well. But
Yes,
yeah,
okay.
I'll have a think of some different biscuits as well. But thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Samantha. It's been so wonderful to speak to you.
It's been a pleasure, Natana.
Thank you so much for listening to the Medical Women podcast. Make sure to subscribe for free on whichever podcast platform you listen on so that you automatically get our episodes. The aim of this podcast is to support and empower as many medical women in their careers as we possibly can. So please share this episode with at least one other medical woman. If you're interested in joining the Medical Women's Federation, we would love to have you, and all links to our website and social media are in the show notes. This podcast has been produced on behalf of the Medical Women's Federation by Dr. Nuthana Bayankaram and Miss Jenna McKenzie. Our music was composed and played by Dr. Kethaki Bayankaram. Thank you so much for listening.